Araris said. Almost everyone was. You were born that same night, in fact. His face clouded with an old sadness. Isarna believed that Septimus was betrayed by another Alaran, and that if his enemies learned that he might possibly have sired an heir, you would surely be killed. So she hid you. She lied about who your mother was. She watercrafted you during your baths to slow down your growth. She wanted anyone who looked at you to think that you were too young to be Septimus's child, born too long after his death. Araris stepped forward and put a hand on Tavi's shoulder. I helped her, he said quietly. He gestured at his scarred, branded face. I did this to myself, Tavi. Araris Valerian was thought to be dead, and if anyone recognized me, they would have been awfully curious to note that I was watching over a boy. So I became Fade, a simple slave. The scar was part of the disguise. No one ever looked past it. Tavi could only stare at the older man. Then he heard himself say, "That's what she wanted to talk about the other day." Araris grimaced and nodded. She was trying. She was afraid of what it might mean if she told you. Tavi's vision blurred over, and the tears seemed to magnify the pain bursting through his chest. All those years, and she was lying to me. She was lying! He jerked his head upright as another thought flashed through his mind like a thunderbolt. That's why I was never able to... She crafted me. She slowed my growth. She stunted my talents, and I never knew. Tavi, Araris said, his voice carefully calm. Wait. You've got to understand that she did what she did because she loves you. She had very few resources to draw upon, and she did everything in her power to protect you. No, Tavi spat. She'd done it to him. The years of humiliation, the bewildered pain as he bore the stigma of a freak, unable to furycraft, scorned and held in contempt by people wherever he went. He hadn't been born a freak, born unlucky, a victim of terrible mischance, as he always thought. Someone had done it to him. His mother had done it to him. Part of Tavi was listening to Araris's words, and part of him knew that the Singulare was probably right, but it was a very small, very distant part. The pain, the outrage, and the humiliation left very little room for anything else. Tavi, Araris said, you've got to calm down. She did the best she could. No! Tavi spat, the anger giving his voice a vicious edge. She lied to me. She took my crafting. His voice gained volume, independently of his control. Do you know how many nights I couldn't sleep? How many times I suffered because I was the furious freak? Do you have any idea all the humiliation I had to go through? How alone I was? Tavi, Araris said, voice quiet, as one speaking to a spooked horse. You've got to control yourself. Think, man. She's out there right now, and she's ripped apart inside. You don't know what is going to happen when you leave on campaign. You don't know if you're ever going to see her again. You need to see her. You need to make this right while you still can. Tavi only stared at him incredulously. Right? Make this right? She's been lying to me since before I could stand up, and I'm supposed to make that right? He mopped a hand over his face and felt it shaking as it smeared tears. You bring this to me today, when we're about to march, and I've got 5,000 men to consider. You throw this in my face today. Tavi, Araris said, she's your mother. She needs this. No. Tavi found himself shaking his head. The list came pouring back through his thoughts. This was too much. It was all far, far too much. He had barely slept in the past 2 days. He was already faced with an enormous and most likely insoluble dilemma in his assignment from the first... from his grandfather. Thousands of lives were dependent upon him. If he truly was the princeps' son and heir, it meant that millions of lives were or would become his responsibility. Not only that, but he had just gained a veritable pantheon of foes who were more like demigods than human beings. And his aunt, his mother, had been lying to him for his entire life. The voice of reason, of understanding, lost the battle to govern Tavi's decisions. She had 20 years to talk to me, if she needed it so badly, Tavi said, his voice rough. She had a lifetime, and I have a legion to move. Tavi, Araris began, his voice a gentle protest. Captain Scipio, Tavi snarled. I have a job to do. Either come with me or get out of the way. Or was the loyalty you pledged me another lie? Araris stiffened at that. His eyes flashed with sudden anger. Without a word, he unlocked the door, stepped back, and opened it for Tavi, coming to rigid attention. Tavi started to stride angrily out the door, but hesitated. He couldn't look at Araris, but he could see the man regarding him on the periphery of his vision. Tavi went quiet, listening to the silence. There were no more footsteps above, no sound of voices or doors opening and closing. The command center felt eerily empty. It was right there in front of me, Tavi said. All the pieces. Even inside my name. Araris said nothing. I can't, Tavi said quietly. Not now. There's too much. The geyser of confusion and hurt threatened to roar out of control again, and Tavi struggled to slow his breathing, to control it. He glanced aside at Araris. The Singulare's face remained impassive as a stone. I'll talk to her when I get back. Araris said nothing. I have duties that must come first, he said quietly. So do you. Araris was silent for an endless moment. Then, quite deliberately, he lifted his fist to his heart, knuckles thumping gently against his armor. When he spoke, his voice was barely more than a whisper, and his words sent a shiver running down Tavi's spine. Hail, he said quietly. Hail, Gaius Octavian, Princeps of Alera. Chapter 11. Cohort! Marcus bellowed in a voice that every single legionary in the Prime Cohort could hear. Halt! The men's steady steps thudded twice more, then fell silent as the ranks of the first Alaran reached the crest of the low ridge overlooking the Khanim's first defensive position. The Prime occupied the center, of course, as it always did. The fourth, holding his cohort's right flank, took a moment to dress its ranks. The seventh, whose tribune spent more time in drill, had no need to straighten out its lines. 3 days to get here, muttered one veteran to another, as Marcus passed. We'd have done it in one. Senatorial guard. Bunch of tenderfoot pansies can't march without a causeway. Marcus snapped his baton back against the veteran's shield and growled, Quiet in the ranks. He gave the man a glare and said, You might hurt the pansies' feelings. No one actually laughed, and great furies help any man who had, but several muffled snorts puffed out of the men of the Prime, and Marcus could sense them settling into the tense, familiar silence of pre-battle. No joke or song or stirring oration could take the fear away from soldiers. Oh, it made for a fine story, no question, the stirring speech upon the edge of battle. But when facing an enemy as determined to survive as you were, talk was cheap, and the men on the ground knew it. The joke had helped, though, providing a small release of tension, and helped the men settle down into the mindset of victorious legionaries, that they were professionals with a job to do, and that it was time to get to work. Marcus stalked up and down the front rank, doing his best to look like he had more interest in his men's discipline than he did in the battle raging 500 yards away. The sound of the fight washed up to their position like distant surf. mercifully indistinct. A distant rumble of drums, a clamour of horns, an ocean of individual cries and shouts. Marcus glanced at the battle as he paced the front rank, his steps steady and unconcerned. A few moments later, horses thundered up through the gaps between the cohorts, and the captain, his singulare, one of the first Alaran's knight's heiress, and an escort of Marat cavalry troopers rode along the front rank of the legion. Marcus turned and saluted as the captain drew his horse up. The captain dismounted and returned the salute. "Good morning, Marcus."
"Sir,"
the first spear replied. The captain swept his eyes over the battle below. Marcus took note of where the young man looked and for how long. Excellent. He was paying attention where he should. He'd always possessed the talent to be a skilled battlefield commander. But even so, he'd come a long way since Marcus had seen him in that first frantic defense of the walls at the Ellen Arch. After a silent moment, he nodded once and said, "What do you think, First Spear?"
"It's their first dance, sir. No telling until it's over."
The battle was being waged along a road, a common trail, not a fury-crafted causeway. The gentle rolling terrain of the vale narrowed at that point, where a pair of old stone bluffs faced one another across an open gap. A small town called Othos filled that opening, but sported only a modest defensive wall. The town was overlooked by a small steadhold high upon the eastern bluff. The omnipresent crows found on any Alaran battlefield whirled overhead in enormous numbers, like a great dark wheel circling high above the embattled town. The Khanim had gone to work on the defences, throwing up earthworks outside the walls of Othos itself, and the wolfish creatures now fought tenaciously to hold the outer wall. The first senatorial had assaulted up the middle, driving hard down the road for the earthworks. Even as Marcus watched, the first assault began to falter, as legionaries failed to bull past the enormous defenders. A moment later the trumpets began to sound a retreat, and the first senatorial pulled back, falling into interspersed columns. More trumpets sounded, and in the gaps between those columns the second senatorial charged, hurling fresh troops into the defenders without giving them a chance to recover from the first assault. The second almost immediately began to push forward, breaching the earthen wall in two places before the Khanim managed to plug the gap, driving the second back. Just as they did, the first senatorial, having reorganized its ranks and given its legionaries a chance to breathe, charged forward in turn, smashing into the weary defenders like an axe into rotten wood. They crested the defences in half a dozen places in the first minute, and then it was the deep braying horns of the Khanim that sounded the retreat.
"Not bad," the captain mused aloud. "That kind of retreat isn't easy to coordinate with a countercharge."
Marcus grunted.
"They've had a year and a half to train, sir, while we were on the job."
"True." The captain watched as the Khanim defenders fell back to the city wall under the cover of a veritable thunderstorm of missiles. The Khanim favoured spears sized to fit them, and the crow-eaten things were thick and long enough to spit a cow upon. Driven by the unbelievable strength of the wolf warriors, they could pierce a legionare, body, armour and all, and still retain enough power to wound the man behind him. Worse than the spears, though, was the sudden thunderstorm of hurled stones. A Khanim warrior could hurl a stone the size of a man's head without any particular effort, and they lobbed them in high arcs, so that they plummeted almost straight down upon the hapless guard below. Armour and helmets of Alaran steel were of limited use against the impact of stones so large and heavy. Even when labouring tribunes began bellowing the orders for their cohorts to shift to a tortoise formation, the rain of stones disrupted the tight ranks necessary for it, leaving men exposed and breaking upraised arms even through the shields they wielded. The primitive missiles were less deadly in a relative sense than well-aimed arrow fire, but they possessed a far greater capacity to inflict crippling injuries, and the ranks of the guard nearest the town walls were badly mauled before they were ordered back to the earthworks and out of rock range. The retreat left the ground before the walls exposed, and the excited crows plunged down toward the corpses,
but not before Marcus was able to get a quick estimate of the fallen. The guard had left the still, armoured forms of between 700 and 800 legionaries lying dead on the killing field.
"Bloody crows," the captain muttered in a tone that only Marcus was close enough to hear.
Disgust tinted the young man's voice.
"The battle's not 15 minutes old, and he's already lost a tithe of one of his legions."
Marcus grunted his agreement.
"Going to be a lonely walk to Mastings at this rate, sir."
"Especially since they outnumbered us to begin with," the captain spat. "We have to pick our moments for attrition tactics."
"Yes, sir,"
Marcus said. The captain drummed the fingertips of one hand against the hilt of his sword.
"I hate standing around watching."
Marcus glanced aside at the captain's profile.
"You've been given your orders, sir. We're a necessary reserve."
Below, the guard legions were massing behind the earthworks. Scaling ropes and ladders were being prepared for the assault on the walls, and half a dozen knights' terror, recognizable by the preposterously outsized mallets they wielded, gathered in the center to smash down the town's gates.
"Crows!"
The captain's voice sounded distant and tired.
"I tried to warn him."
Marcus caught a movement out of the corner of his eye and glanced up to see twin arrowhead formations of Knights Aeris streaking through the sky toward the town. The captain had seen them too.
"There they go." "Textbook," Marcus agreed.
Another trumpet sounded, and with a roar, the guard plunged forward. Spheres of white-hot flame burst into being upon the walls overlooking the gate as the guards' Knights Ignis unleashed their furies upon the defenders. The missile storm began again, but the two formations of Knights Aeris strafed the battlements, sending Carnim flying as they were caught in the enormous gale of the knights' combined wind streams. The legionaries charged, ladders and ropes rising, even as the knights' terror rushed the gate. The captain's head snapped aside, and he pointed up at the western bluff.
"There!"
Marcus looked up to see dark shapes rising from concealment atop the bluff, and they were soon mirrored by more movement on the eastern side. Marcus could see forms atop both bluffs moving strangely, but it took him a moment to realize what they were doing. They were spinning in place. The stones that began to fall upon the conveniently massed ranks of the guard made the hand-tossed projectiles of moments before seem like pebbles by comparison. Stones half the height of a man came crashing down, lethal to anyone beneath them, crippling to anyone close enough to be struck, as the stone rebounded from the earth and tumbled wildly. Marcus stared in mute surprise. It would take an earthcrafter of considerable talent to throw stones that size, and the Carnim had no earthcrafters. Not only that, but even if they had been strong enough to throw the boulders, they could not possibly have been thrown at such speed to such distance, and yet they were doing it. The captain narrowed his eyes, staring at the bluffs, and let out a sudden snarl.
"Slingers," he said. "Bloody crows! They're slingers!"
Marcus shot a glance at the captain and peered more closely. The young officer was right by the great furies. The Carnim atop the bluffs were whirling the enormous stones at the end of long, heavy chains. Each slinger would rush forward, get the stone moving, then begin to spin, whirling the boulders in great circles, gathering speed, until they released them to sail out and down onto the guard below. Horns blared with frantic authority as the deadly rain disrupted formations and sowed panic and confusion in the ranks. The Knights Aeris formations wheeled up and separated, each soaring toward one of the bluffs, to suppress the slingers and sweep them from their position. Marcus felt nothing but contempt for the arrogance of the commander who had sent those men into the battle unprepared. It was no fault of Arnus's men, but they were going to die for it. As the knights bore down upon the bluffs, they began to fall out of formation. Men twisted and jerked in mid-air, then began plummeting out of the skies to smash upon the ground below.
Balists, Marcus grunted.
The captain nodded tightly. Without the knight's heiress to suppress the battlements, the Khanim began the terrible rain of smaller stones again, hurling them down upon the legionaries attempting the walls. They regained their positions around and over the gate, slamming stones down at the knight's terror attempting to destroy it, forcing them to draw back or risk a crushed skull.
Crows,
Marcus said.
The only thing the guard is doing is providing the Khanim cover from our own firecrafters.
He watched as men struggled and died, as the chaos of the battle took hold of the legionaries. The pressure on the walls faltered, and Marcus had seen battles enough to know that the guard would soon withdraw, whether or not their officers ordered it. The captain snarled again.
I'm not waiting any longer.
He turned to Sir Callum, the knight heiress who had ridden up with him, and said, Go! Callum dismounted and dragged a roll of bright scarlet cloth from his saddlebag. He took a pair of quick steps and flung himself into the air, soaring upward. He let the scarlet banner come unrolled as he did, until he was dragging the 20-yard signal flag behind him. Almost instantly fresh trumpets sounded, silvery notes that seemed to float down from overhead. There was a quiet rumble like distant thunder, and suddenly horsemen flying the banner of the first Aleran were racing along the top of the eastern bluff. They fell upon the slingers holding those heights, putting a sudden halt to the rain of enormous stones. On the western bluff, the regular cadence of a war chant drifted down through the morning air, audible over the scream of battle thanks to its rhythm. Along that ridge appeared the solid formation of the first Aleran's 13th cohort, the Battle Crows, marching at the quick step for the Khanim positions overlooking Othos. Once in position, a concerted battle roar went up from them, and the Battle Crows slammed into the Khanim like a single enormous hammer. A small sphere of blue fire exploded in the air over the bluff, and was echoed by a second sphere over the other bluff.
There's the signal, Marcus murmured.
Sharpshooters cleared.
The captain growled under his breath.
Take 'em, Crassus.
20 armored knights heiress, wind crafters of the first Aleran's knights Pisces, came screaming down out of the sun. They dived upon the battlements, blinding and confusing the defending Khanim long enough to allow them to land and clear out a short section of wall. The guard's officers saw them come in and seized the opportunity. Scaling ladders went up in the area the Knights Pisces had secured, and legionaries began flooding onto the battlements to support them. Khanim horns began to bray again, and the defense crumbled. The guard surged raggedly forward, still too disordered to press home a charge that might have destroyed a sizable portion of the Khanim defenders. The guard banners, red and blue fields behind the Senate's silver laurel leaf, were lifted upon the walls. The guard poured into the town, securing it. Several minutes later, Marcus let out a slow breath and shook his head.
They let us take it.
The captain nodded.
Could have been worse.
A messenger wearing the livery of the First Senatorial rode up the First Aleran's battle lines toward the captain and Marcus. The young man dismounted, gave the captain a salute, and said,
His Honor the Senator requests and requires that you meet with him in 1 hour, sir.
The captain nodded.
My compliments to his honour, and I will be there.
The messenger saluted again and departed. Marcus frowned.
Senator isn't going to be happy with you, sir. He ordered you to sit tight.
The captain smiled bleakly.
That's why I waited for things to get as bad as they did before I sent them in. He might scream and rant, but he can't get away with laying charges against me for turning a rout into a victory. And he knows it.
Marcus grunted.
Probably true.
The captain stared down at the dead, beneath their dark, shifting blanket of hungry crows. Here and there among the gleaming forms of fallen legionaries, Marcus could see the darker, larger form of a Khanae. No few of them had fallen, but the legions had paid a ruinous price to drive the enemy from a position he had never intended to keep.
Marcus,
the captain said.
Sir.
Send up Foss and his men. The guard took a mauling today,
and this is the first time their Tribune's Medica have real casualties to treat. They'll need the help.
Yes, sir.
The captain was quiet for a moment. Then he said, I wish I could have acted sooner, Marcus. But if I had, Arnos would have had cause to strip me of command.
Yes, sir,
Marcus said very quietly.
He would have.
The captain rubbed his hands against the sides of his trousers, as if trying to wipe something off them.
All right, he said quietly. Let's get moving, Centurion. It's a long way to Mastings.
Chapter 12 Tavi rode into Othos with Araris at his side. The town's gates had been thrown wide open, though not without effort. Tons of earth had been piled up behind them when they were closed, and the Knights Terror, who had been part of the assault, were only now finishing crafting it clear. Look at that, Tavi murmured to Araris. Even if they had broken the gates, the guard couldn't have pushed through all of that. They just wanted to make us stand still while they dropped rocks on our heads. Araris nodded grimly and called out to the squad who held the gate.
Centurion! Could you direct us to the Senator's command, please?
A blocky man with a centurion's baton and blood on his helmet and breastplate looked down from the walls. He stared at Araris and his branded face for a second, and his lip lifted in a snarl of contempt, until his eyes moved past him to Tavi. Tavi said nothing. Captains and other important people weren't expected to do the talking. That's what their retainers were for. The centurion nodded toward the young captain and thumped a fist to his chest in salute.
Town square, big white house. Used to be the local count's residence.
My thanks, Araris said, the faintest trace of irony in his voice, and they continued on their way.
The leggy Marat horses moved at a kind of dancing trot down the central street of Othos, their hooves clopping distinctly on the cobblestones. The air carried a strong scent of Carnim, an odour that was pungent, musty, and somehow a little metallic. The streets were very quiet as they kept going. With the exception of several passing squads of legionaries, they saw no one else. In fact, Tavi's mouth suddenly filled with bitterness, and he swallowed, fighting his stomach back down.
The people. Where are the townspeople?
Araris's expression became colder, but he remained silent. They passed from mid-morning sunlight into one of the vast cold shadows cast by the bluffs rising on either side of the town. Tavi shivered. They came to the town square, situated flush against the town's southern wall, and found out where the people of Othos had gone. There were perhaps 800 or 900 townsfolk seated on the stones of the square, and they were surrounded by lines of grim-faced legionaries. More of the guard had taken positions on the southern wall, most of them archers. About half of them were facing the square, rather than to the south, where the Carnim forces were, Tavi fervently hoped, still retreating. The square was completely silent, the men and women and children sitting very still, not speaking. Here and there a dog barked or an infant cried, and the spring wind occasionally slammed shut a door left hanging open. They were 50 yards away, but even Tavi's limited watercrafting senses could detect their quiet, acidic fear. It was a hideous sensation, because unlike his own personal fear, this emotion seemed unable to remain inside him. It was as if each part of him, his limbs, his hair, his very skin, could feel each independent terror of its own, and the sensation rolled over him in a sickening wave. He looked away from them, closed his eyes, and rested his hand on the hilt of his sword. Tavi drew upon the silent cold strength in the weapon, let it roll up over him and armor him against the townsfolk's terror. The sensation faded at once, enough to let him get control of himself again and continue riding. They rode up to a large white house. Legionaries were stationed outside its front garden, and Tavi spotted one of the senator's singulares, a small, dark-haired woman with a bow,
on watch at the house's front door. As they dismounted, one of the valets from the first senatorial emerged from the house and hurried to take the reins of their horses.
"Good day, Captain Scipio."
"Good day." Tarvi quickly searched his memory. "Faris, isn't it?" The valet gave him a quick smile and bowed his head.
"Indeed, sir. The senator is waiting for you. Go inside the front door, and you'll find him in the office on the left."
"Thank you, Faris," Tarvi said. He glanced at Araris, who nodded. Tarvi straightened his cloak and started inside, striding briskly. Araris kept pace, walking slightly behind him and to the left, his eyes narrow and wary. The entry hall of the house held several more legionaries on guard, and the remainder of Arnus's singulares, a nasty-looking bunch all in all, though none quite so unsettling as Phrygia Navaris. Upon seeing them, she rose, slender and deadly in her all-black clothing, and approached.
"Good day, Captain," she said politely.
No, thought Tarvi, not politely. Something about her tone seemed subtly inconsistent, as if she was speaking a language she had learned sound by sound, without knowing the meaning behind it. It was an imitation of politeness and nothing more.
"If your singulare would be so kind as to wait here, the senator is expecting you."
"Sir," Araris said quietly. It was as close to making a protest as he ever came. "I'm sure the senator won't mind if you take position outside the office door," Tarvi told him.
Navaris gave them a narrow glance and said, "Not that it would matter where he was standing, if it came to that."
Araris paused at that and turned very deliberately to stare at the cutter. She returned the stare in kind. "You're probably right," Tarvi said. "After all, there are five of you and only one of him. That's a serious mismatch." He took off his cloak and tossed it at Navaris's chest, as if she was a mere attendant. "So why don't you run along and get another five or six? That should make things even." The woman caught the cloak on pure reflex, and her flat, somehow reptilian eyes flickered with a sudden incomprehensible light. Tarvi ignored her and strode past her to the indicated doorway. Araris followed him, glanced around inside the room after Tarvi stepped into it, and took up a position immediately outside the office. Arnos sat at a desk, reading from the top of a stack of papers.
"Captain, come in."
Tarvi strode to the front of Arnos's desk and saluted. "Reporting is ordered, sir." Arnos said nothing. He read to the bottom of his current page, flipped it to the bottom of the stack, and only then looked up at Tarvi. He just stared for a moment and rather pointedly did not invite him to sit. After a long silence, Arnos said,
"I ordered you to hold back, Captain. You were our reserve force."
"Yes, sir," Tarvi said. "There was no time to consult with you while the guard was engaged. I saw that the leading elements of the guard needed support, and provided it as best I could." Arnos gave him a wintry little smile.
"Really? To reach the tops of those bluffs, one must ride nearly 3 miles to the east and 1.5 miles to the west before usable ascents can be found. Which means your units had to cover twice that distance to reach the Khanim positions on the bluffs. Which means that you had to have dispatched them almost the moment fighting began."
"Obviously," thought Tarvi. But that wasn't the sort of remark one could make to a superior officer without making him look like the ass he was. Tarvi remained silent. Arna snorted a moment later.
"Granted, I'm glad they were there when we needed them. But I was counting on your support to be available at need. If the enemy had approached with a more extensive force, for example, I might have needed the first Aleran to reinforce the assault, or redeploy to hold off the second force."
"And the first Aleran would have been there, sir," Tarvi replied. "Minus 2 Aeli of our auxiliaries and a single infantry cohort." Arnos tilted his head to one side.
"You're howling barbarians, you mean?"
Tavi reminded himself not to be goaded by such an obvious attempt before he replied.
The Marat cavalry. Yes, sir.
Arnas made a tent of his fingers and frowned at Tavi.
I was given to understand that they went to battle almost entirely naked. Men and women alike.
Marat can tolerate greater extremes of temperature than the average Alaran, sir. In their homelands they generally wear a breechcloth and find it sufficient. Arnas said, imbuing the sound with skepticism.
How did you convince them to wear uniforms?
The Marat have very formal cultural conventions with regards to the giving of gifts, sir. If one is given a gift and does not put it to use, it is considered a kind of insult to the gift giver. So I went around to each of the Marat who had come to support the first Alaran and personally gave them their uniform and armor. He shrugged. They have to wear it now, or they'll be insulting me. They're too polite to do that. Arnas shook his head again.
One might question your judgment, Captain, in sending a crowd of savages on such a critical mission.
One might question my judgment in sending anyone at all, sir, given my orders. I was confident they would do their job, and they did. The senator gave him a flat look for several seconds, then waved a hand as if brushing away a tendril of smoke or an annoying insect.
The infantry cohort you sent to the opposite bluff. How did they arrive so quickly?
That was our mounted infantry cohort, sir, Tavi said. The one I mentioned at the meeting.
Ah, Arnas said. I suppose that today the concept appears to have been proven somewhat useful.
That's why we put them together, sir, Tavi replied. Increased tactical operations. Arnas grimaced.
I disapprove of such unconventional stratagems, Captain. Alera's legions have kept her safe and growing for more than 1,000 years. Their methods have stood the test of time and proven themselves over and over again. I'm not opposed to intelligent innovation, mind you, but it's an incredible arrogance to declare the proven methods of 1,000 years insufficient, then to employ untested theories of combat when any weakness in those theories will cost men their lives.
Tavi had to force himself not to retort that his untested theories had helped them survive for more than 2 years, and that his own forces had taken but 7 casualties today, none of them fatal, while the guards' legions had lost nearly 7% of their total numbers.
Yes, sir, he said. In addition, this violation of your orders is a serious matter. The chain of command must be preserved at all costs. If officers begin to lose their discipline, begin picking and choosing which orders they will obey, it is only a matter of time until such behavior spreads to the ranks. And then we have no legion. Only a mob of brigands. Do you understand?
I understand, sir, Tavi said.
That said,
Arnas shook his head and sighed.
Your display of initiative saved men's lives today, Captain. So I'm going to overlook your disobedience.
His eyes hardened.
Once.
Tavi nodded.
Yes, sir.
Arnas picked up another piece of paper from the desk, folded it in thirds, and held it out. Tavi took it.
Your orders, the senator said.
Yes, sir.
Dismissed.
Tavi saluted and turned on a heel to march out. Just as he reached the door, Arnas said,
Captain.
Tavi turned.
Sir.
Arnas said,
Captain Narlus asked me to thank you for sending your Tribune Medica and the First Alaran's healers up to assist with the wounded. They saved a good many lives that might otherwise have been lost.
No thanks are necessary, sir. He paused for a beat and added, After all, we're all on the same side here. Arnas flipped over the next page on his stack with rather more force than necessary.
That will be all, Captain.
Yes, sir, Tavi said, and left the office.
Araris fell into step behind him as Tavi stalked from the home and back out toward the horses.
What's that?
Araris asked quietly as they mounted. Our orders, Tavi said. He fought down the sick feeling in his stomach as he unfolded the piece of paper and scanned over it. His horse danced restlessly in place as he did.
Oh, he said. Oh, great furies.
Araris frowned and tilted his head slightly.
He's putting us in charge of the civilians, Tavi said quietly.
The first Alaran is to march them to a field just east of here.
And...
His voice broke and he couldn't recover it. He shook his head and passed the paper over to the Singulare. He didn't watch Araris read it. He couldn't take his eyes from the families huddling together on the stones of the square, pale, silent, and terrified. Araris's voice emerged, soft with shock and disbelief, as he read the last few words of the orders aloud.
There, he said. To be executed.
Chapter 13.
Are you quite sure they must come off? Asked the First Lord. It really seems that it would be more comfortable to leave them on.
They had stopped beside an old and seldom used trail to take a drink from a convenient spring, and Amara had noted that Gaius had been concealing a limp while the small party's steps had quickened over the last few yards. Now the First Lord sat on a camp stool Bernard had assembled, and the big woodsman knelt before the most powerful man in Alera, unlacing the man's boots.
"I'm certain, sire," Bernard rumbled. "Sore feet are nothing to take lightly, especially not with so much ground still to cover."
"This is somewhat embarrassing, I confess," Gaius said. "I have even increased the amount of walking I have done over the past several months to prepare for this."
Walking up stairs and over paving stones is a far cry from a cross-country march, sire,
Bernard rumbled. His nostrils flared and he shook his head.
I'm going to slide the boot off now. I can smell some blood, so the stocking might stick. Point your toe, sire, and I'll have it off as quick as I can.
The First Lord grimaced and nodded.
Aye. Let's have it done.
Without being asked, Amara moved to stand behind Gaius and brace her hands on his shoulders, steadying him. It was a somewhat startling feeling. Though the First Lord was as hale a man for his years as could be found in Alera, and though he looked like a man in his 40s gone to early silver, the flesh of his shoulders felt thin and somehow frail. Amara felt her touch grow cautious. The last thing the realm needed was for her to accidentally dislocate Gaius's shoulders while Bernard attempted to put his feet right. The boots stuck, and it was only after a few moments of effort, some careful twisting, and a hiss of pain from Gaius that Bernard was able to get the boot off his foot. As he had predicted, the pale stocking beneath was dark with blood. Bernard took a deep breath and frowned thoughtfully. Then he looked up at Amara and said,
"Get the cooking pot and fill it with water if you would, Countess."
There was something tense about the way he held his head, Amara could tell. She paused for a moment and frowned at him, her own expression questioning.
"The water, Countess," Bernard repeated, his voice steady. "I'll need to wet the stockings before I can take them off and see how bad it is."
She gave him a frown, but fetched the pot and headed for the stream as he had bid her. It took him another quarter of an hour to have both of Gaius's feet bare and wiped clean with a cloth, and to inspect the damage. He sat back a moment later, frowning.
"How bad?" Gaius asked.
Bernard looked steadily at him for a moment before he said,
"I've seen worse, but they're blistered badly. How long have they been paining you, sire?" "At my age, you hardly notice one pain amidst all the rest," Gaius replied. "The first day wasn't too bad. They weren't comfortable last night, but they didn't get bad until this morning."
Bernard nodded.
"The real concern is infection. If we're early enough to stop that, we should be able to handle the rest easily enough.
"Quite embarrassing," Gaius muttered, staring down at his swollen ankles. "Sore feet. This is hardly dignified."
"Travel sores are no respecters of persons, sire," Bernard said. "First thing, let's get you on the ground with your feet up. It will help reduce the swelling and some of the discomfort."
"That would be most appreciated, Count Bernard," Gaius sighed.
With the woodsman's help, the First Lord settled himself on the ground, his feet propped up on the stool, where he frowned at them in disapproval while gnawing an apple. Bernard dumped out the water and went to the spring to refill it, and Amara went with him. "How bad?" she asked quietly. He shook his head.
"I've seen worse. Once. On a legion runner who had enough metal crafting to ignore the pain and not enough sense to know he shouldn't. He took infection so badly even my sister couldn't help him. He lost the foot, and the fever burned out most of his wits."
Amara bit her lip and brushed her hair back from her forehead. "That bad?" Bernard grimaced.
"We got to the First Lord more quickly, though great furies know what might have happened if you hadn't spotted him limping."
"Quickly enough?"
"Amara,"
he sighed.
"I don't know."
Amara took a deep breath and nodded. "What can we do?"
"We can have him craft the wounds closed," Bernard said.
Amara shook her head.
"No, he can't. Any of his crafting at all will give our position away and make the mission a failure."
Bernard gave her a direct look.
"So will his maiming or death, love."
Amara glared at him for a moment, but looked away and shook her head. "Is he in any immediate danger?" Bernard stood up with the pot full.
"He's not going to pitch over dead any moment now, no. If he does take fever, it will take some time to kill him. Days, probably. Maybe longer."
"Then we have some time," Amara said.
"We might," Bernard said. "But then again, we might not. An infection could be taking hold while we stand here talking."
Bernard folded his arms.
"This is a humble little wound. But it doesn't care who he is. It's capable of killing him if he doesn't receive proper medical attention."
Amara folded her arms close to her belly and frowned down at the stream.
"Let me put it this way," Bernard said slowly.
He turned to face Amara full on, planting his feet at shoulder's width.
"It is beyond foolishness to risk the First Lord's life on something this trivial. I won't allow it."
Amara stared at her husband's face for a moment.
"Excuse me?"
"I won't allow it," he repeated, his tone gentle and immovable. "I'll give away our presence myself if I must."
Amara forced herself to keep a hot answer from flying from her lips.
"Bernard," she said quietly, "that's treason."
"Not the way I see it," he said. "I'm sworn to protect the crown. The oath never said anything about protecting the crown from anyone except himself. You swore a similar oath, I believe."
"You can't make a decision like this," Amara sputtered.
"I already have," he replied. "It's been a long time since Gaius was on campaign, and you've never been on one. You've never seen men die of infection."
He looked down and away.
"It robs them of everything, Amara. All dignity, all strength. They waste away, so fast you can almost see it happening."
He shuddered.
"The realm is barely holding together as it is. Should anything happen to Gaius? Should he die like that?"
She bit her lip and touched his shoulder.
"He knows that there are risks, love. He has chosen to face them."
"He is responsible for more lives than his own," Bernard responded. "What is so important that it warrants risking his life?"
"I don't know," Amara replied quietly. "He didn't tell me."
Bernard shot her an incredulous look.
"You don't even know why we're doing this?"
She shook her head.
"Then bloody crows, Amara, why are you opposing me?"
"Because I trust his judgment," Amara said quietly.
because I swore an oath. She paused briefly and added, just as you did. Bernard grunted, as if to acknowledge the touch. Amara leaned in close against him, and he slid an arm quietly around her. She laid her cheek against his chest. If he didn't tell you either, why are you here? Bernard's voice rumbled in his chest, a pleasant buzzing sensation in her ear.
He said he needed a skilled woodsman and scout, someone he could trust.
He breathed out a little through his nose, a wisp of a laugh.
And he said you'd be there. I suppose he knew it would be reason enough for me.
Amara lifted her head suddenly to stare intently into her husband's face. Just as he knew that once we were back together I would be too distracted by you to ask too many questions. She felt a wry smile twist her mouth. Until it was too late to change our minds, I suppose. Bernard frowned and squinted back toward where Gaius sat and said,
"We're not going a step farther until I know exactly what we're walking into."
Amara frowned in thought for a moment and spoke slowly. I suppose my duty would be to oppose you putting an end to this mission. Strictly speaking.
You did that once before, Bernard replied,
his eyes brightening with brief amusement.
You'll recall how it worked out.
His expression grew more serious.
You couldn't stop me from compromising us, Amara. And without using Furycraft, I doubt he could do it either. Even if he could walk right now.
Amara nodded slowly. Just as well, perhaps.
Oh?
It gives us a lever to use on him. She glanced back at the First Lord. He keeps secrets purely as a reflex action these days. I can't serve or protect him if I'm kept blind and wandering in the dark. But... Bernard found her hand with his and squeezed gently.
But what?
She felt her lips tighten. It just doesn't feel right. So many have turned against him. Fidelius! Tears filled her eyes in approximate tempo with a surge of heated anger as she thought of her treacherous mentor, and it became impossible to speak.
It isn't the same, love,
he told her quietly.
You're trying to protect him and using your best judgment. It isn't the same thing at all.
I hope you're right, she said quietly. She shook her head, blinking the tears away before they could fall. Then she nodded once, composed herself, and strode back over to Gaius, Bernard in step beside her. The First Lord looked back and forth between their expressions, then said,
Ah.
Amara came to a stop before him and knelt down to put her eyes more or less on level with his own. Sire, Count Calderon... He lifted a hand with a little impatient wave and glanced at Bernard.
We're not walking another mile until you know what we're getting into. Something like that.
Bernard snorted through his nose.
Not another step, actually, sire.
Gaius winced, shifting one of his legs.
Is it that bad?
Bernard approached as well, kneeling down and brushing away a layer of forest detritus with one hand, revealing a number of small white and pink crystals. He dropped them into the pan and began swirling the water as he spoke.
Without proper watercrafting. It has the potential to be very bad, sire, yes.
Gaius made a disgusted noise.
I suppose I'd be a fool to bring along an expert woodsman only to ignore his advice.
Bernard's mouth quirked up at one corner.
I'd never say that, sire.
Gaius's teeth flashed white for a moment.
Not in so many words, anyway, eh?
He studied his own raw and bloodied feet.
Your recommendation involves my crafting the injuries away, I take it. Or flying to someone who can, Bernard said. What are my chances if I don't?
If we're in time to prevent any infection, I can probably take care of it on my own. If we're too late, he shrugged, you'll sicken, take a fever, and eventually die. Our best hope is that you will retain the ability to rectify the problem on your own before the fever takes you too far to sustain such a crafting.
Which would compromise our mission, Gaius said quietly, rendering it an unacceptable option.
Sire, Amara said, your untimely death would be no more acceptable.
The First Lord glanced at her.
Untimely? Yes. But that seems rather unavoidable at this point.
He wiggled the toes of one foot and winced.
No infection has set in as yet. I believe our best option is to maintain a positive frame of mind and proceed. It's a very real risk, sire, Bernard said, and there was nothing subservient in his voice. What could possibly be so important that it warrants such a risk to yourself and to the realm?
Gaius frowned at Bernard. Then he tilted his head, brow furrowed.
Well, this is an interesting iteration of the Ludus board. A steadholder with more power than a paired cursor and First Lord. I can't stop you from acting without revealing myself, and I am not at all certain that Amara could do it either.
Bernard nodded.
I've got you by the balls, sire.
Gaius, now leaning up on his elbows, let his head fall back with a brief, tense laugh.
So it would seem. Very well. We will speak of my purpose, after which we will proceed at our best pace.
Bernard frowned.
I can't promise that. We will, Gaius said, and there was a cold flicker at the back of his eyes. This is necessary, Count. It will be done.
His voice went quiet.
And as formidable as you are in your current position, yet do I advise you not to test me.
Bernard's hands froze for a moment as he crumbled some kind of herb into the salted water in the pot. It was the only sign of his discomfort.
I can only promise that I will act on my conscience.
Well enough, Gaius replied. With Bernard's help, he returned to his seat upon the camp stool and slipped his battered feet into the pot. He let out a hiss of pain and shuddered a few times, but then his breathing steadied. A moment later he opened his eyes, and Amara pressed a cup of bitter willow tea into his hands. He nodded his thanks to her.
This touches upon your last visit to Kalare, actually.
Amara lifted an eyebrow.
In what way?
Not for familiarity, I am sure. We only covered the last few miles on the ground.
Similar motivation, the First Lord said. You remember the necessity for bringing Lady Placida back whole and unharmed?
Amara nodded.
There are several dangerous furies back in her lands that are being held in check by her will. Had she died, they would have been loosed on her people.
Precisely, Gaius said.
And Kalaris, whom I will never fault for lack of ambition, has done something almost as brilliant as it is insane. He's intentionally stirred up furies of terrible power on his own and bound them to his will in the same way. Amara took in a deep breath.
He hopes to preserve his life?
Not at all, Gaius said in a sober tone. He's too proud to suffer through imprisonment. And he knows that we could assume control of those furies once he was taken away and we had time to work. His goal is much simpler, Countess. He hopes to drag as many lives as possible into the underworld with him, preferably including my own.
Bernard scratched at his beard, frowning.
Sire, what kind of furies are you talking about here?
Gaius took a slow breath and said,
One of the great furies, Count.
Amara frowned.
Great furies? What?
I mean, there are actually...
Gaius's mouth gained an edge of grim amusement.
You think we swear by them simply for show?
No.
They exist, the great furies. A dozen or so that I'm aware of. Creatures so old and vast that our entire existence upon this world, 1,000 years of growth and strength,